question is, can I reach the microphone? So now my first task is to introduce Julia Horne, as we'll do a sort of Tweedledum and Tweedledee act. Julia is not only the organiser of this seminar, but as many of you know, she's the university historian and a senior research fellow here. She's the author of the wonderfully illustrated and widely praised book, Pursuit of Wonder, How Australia's Landscape Was Explored, Nature Discovered and Tourism Unleashed, published in 2005. And she's also the co-author with Geoffrey Sherrington of the forthcoming Sydney, The Making of a Public University. And today she's going to talk to us about Samuel Mackackie's gift to the nation.
Welcome back. Now, what I want to do today is really to introduce you to Sir Samuel Mackackie, a man who bequeathed to the university a large bequest early in the 20th century. And I want to use his story to explore and unravel Australia's philanthropic tradition of about 100 years, so from about 1850 up to 1945. In short, when Mackackie died in 1919, his will left over £1 million to various organisations, and to put that amount in today's values, that approximates to about $65 to $70 million. That's a conservative estimate, so probably a bit more. And the largest proportion of that went to universities, with Sydney and Queensland the two beneficiaries. Now, it wasn't Sydney University's first large bequest, nor the last, but rather part of a tradition of giving to the university that stretched back to its first decade after the university opened in 1852. And the first endowment, in fact, that was given to the university occurred just a few months after students first started studying. So what I think this shows is that really there was a willingness by a number of citizens of New South Wales to support the university as a public institution. And the Mackackie bequest provides historical insight into why this was so. Well, Samuel Mackackie made his fortune from Australian sheep. Mackackie was born in Ireland into a strict Presbyterian family. He was the eldest son of an Irish linen merchant who also owned a farm, which is where Mackackie acquired both his agricultural knowledge as well as the clerical skills to run a business, which I think obviously meant that he could make a lot of money when he came out here through sheep. Now, he wasn't university educated. His formal education ended before Ireland's universities had modernised and opened to the sons of Ireland's emerging middle classes. In 1856, aged 23, he arrived in Melbourne to try his luck, first as a station hand on his uncle's property near Horsham in Victoria, but it didn't take him long to acquire, with his family's help, a share in a sheep station on the Riverina. Over the years, he bought a number of properties in far western New South Wales and southern Queensland, and by the 1880s, his land holdings were so great that he was said to remark that his stations cut into strips half a mile wide and joined end to end would reach from Australia to England. So he's a bit of a mathematician, obviously his clerical skills. He was the son of Britain's emerging commercial classes, who became one of New South Wales' richest pastoralists of the time. Now, Mackackie created a large homestead on his Riverina property, Coonong, where he entertained leading men of the day, including Sir George Reid, Premier of New South Wales in the lead-up to Federation in the 1890s, and who, of course, then became our fourth Prime Minister. Like Mackackie, Reid was also Presbyterian, and it's almost certain that the strong Presbyterian networks of colonial New South Wales brought together these two men, one a man of the land and the other an urban politician. And I think that this friendship is probably really significant for Mackackie's subsequent university philanthropy. We often know Reid as the founder of Australian Federation, and we forget that in fact he was really crucial to making the new public education system work in late 19th century New South Wales, which included support for various innovations to broaden access to university education. The university, as a public institution, was the pinnacle, as it were, of this new public education system that included the establishment of selective high schools, of public high schools and so forth. He also supported the introduction, for example, of a bill to establish evening courses at the university. Now, as I say, these weren't Reid's ideas, but they had been brought to him by activist professors and others on the Senate who cared about these things, who wanted the university to reconceptualise its relationship with the public. But they certainly appealed greatly to Reid, and possibly, I mean, we don't know for sure, but possibly he spoke to McCackie of the potential of the university to reach a broader public. We've got really, you know, we don't have very much to go by to absolutely establish this, but we do know that McCackie had carefully considered his main bequests. You know, he talked about them and all the rest many years before he died, so it wasn't a whim at all. Now, the terms of the bequest, worked out with his solicitor and executor, James Ashton, operated differently from previous benefactions. Upon Samuel McCackie's death in 1919, this £1 million was placed in a trust to be invested by the McCackie estate, and the income dispensed annually to the organisations listed in the will. About a third went to the University of Sydney, and the same proportion to establish and maintain a relief scheme for members of the Australian Military and Naval Expeditionary Forces, their widows and children, much of which was in fact focused on education, providing bursaries and scholarships for bright young children of these returned soldiers to support themselves to matriculation, you know, often at the state's selective high schools, and then come on to university. Now, of the remaining third, about a sixth went to the University of Queensland and the rest to other organisations. But in addition to establishing the trust, McCackie also bequeathed individual but much smaller amounts to a number of boys' private schools, including Scots in Bellevue Hill, children's homes, charities and the Presbyterian Church. And I think it's interesting that children's homes, charities and the Presbyterian Church, those are significant because unlike the trust that was used to support the universities, these smaller bequests indicated, in, you know, what you might call a more traditional approach to philanthropy as charity by supporting organisations that sought to improve society's ills through the eradication of poverty. And I think the trust for the university, for the universities, was, it was not seen as an act of charity. So in that sense, it's a different sort of philanthropic tradition we're seeing, but more on that soon. In general, though, his will proclaimed a belief in the importance of education. In fact, his true love was engineering, but unlike Peter Nicol Russell, who several decades earlier, around 1900, had given a great endowment to the Faculty of Engineering, McCackie's bequest was much more general in its terms, and this is how it was expressed in his will: to be applied to such purposes as the respective senates of the said universities may from time to time determine. Now, in the months after the bequest was announced, the university conducted a series of what I'd like to call public conversations about how to use the income. And this was conducted both within the university as well, and really significantly, more generally in the community throughout New South Wales, including its rural districts. Advice and requests flow. There are several huge files in the archives of all these requests and advice on how this money should be used flowing in from all over New South Wales, as well as, of course, from within the universities. And there's one that I love. A teacher from Wagga Wagga High School proposed that after the needs of the art side had been met, and we all know that no faculty is so much in need of extension, there should be matriculation scholarships for rural students. Well, in the end, the university decided to address what they saw as the many deficiencies in the teaching departments, including the need to fund salary increases. There'd be no increases in professorial salaries even for decades, as well as fund fledgling research projects. So the idea of research in this interwar period was just starting to infiltrate and influence universities in Australia, and also new positions, of course, in various disciplines, which became known, or at least some of them became known, as the Macaque Chairs. And those disciplines included English language, French, German, psychology, biochemistry, geography and dentistry. And some of those were being newly funded. As the Wagga Wagga teacher had hoped, the Faculty of Arts in fact received much attention. Now, what can the Macaque bequest tell us about the tradition of Australian philanthropy? I think first, it was part of a new type of philanthropy that in Australia can be seen to have developed from the 1850s with the establishment of colonial universities. One of the distinctive features of Australian colonial universities, such as Sydney, was that they were founded as public universities with a social contract, as it were, to allow the child of every class, the founders said, to become great and useful in the destinies of his country. They're the original words, not mine. To our eyes, this social contract, as expressed back then, can look quite narrow, since only those who passed an entrance exam could come to university, and of course the social customs of the time necessarily excluded women, amongst others, from sitting for the exam. But in the context of mid-19th century universities, this social contract was designed to extend what we might call an educational franchise to a public more broadly conceived than that in the past. At Sydney, when Sydney was designed as a concept rather than the actual buildings, in the late 1840s and 1850s, it was designed then to help overcome the deep religious divisions, especially between Protestants and Irish Catholics, but also other social divisions in a society only recently finished with convict transportation, and of course where the concept of class was really quite fluid. And with a system that offered scholarships to about a third of the university's enrolment in its first decade, those figures improved as time went on, there was also hope to attract bright students regardless of social origins, who were the first of their family to go to university. So that this social contract, up until Macaque's death in 1919, really developed quite significantly from decade to decade as it broke more barriers and the educational franchise extended further and further to include women, rural students, and even more who came from what might be called poorer backgrounds, not necessarily always the working class, but you know, that other poorer group who were more socially diffuse. So the new type of philanthropy, one different in emphasis from the traditional idea of philanthropy as religious charity, supported public institutions, including museums and libraries, that sought to extend education beyond previous boundaries. Now, secondly, university philanthropists were prepared to support the idea of liberal education as a first principle of university education. So that notion that a broad general education was what was needed to set up a person for life. Now, at that time, even in fact at the founding of this university, the place of liberal education within universities was already under attack around the world, including here, with antagonists arguing that the main purpose of universities should be to provide a skilled workforce. Well, actually, everyone was arguing it should be to provide a skilled workforce, but the antagonists were then saying that was achieved best with an emphasis on skill acquisition with really less need for a general education. But the Macaque bequest enabled the university to strengthen its belief in a liberal education as a foundation for the future. And we need to remember that despite Macaque's own interest in engineering, he'd actually chosen to frame the request as in general terms as possible. Now, thirdly, university philanthropy was often conceived at this time as an investment. By the 1880s, the university chancellor, professors and others spoke publicly, these public conversations, about the need for philanthropic support of colonial intellectual culture. And that was the phrase they actually used at that time to describe a major purpose of the university. While there were other civic enterprises that engaged in intellectual pursuits, such as the Learned Society, some of which were very old, and which from the late 19th century also benefited from people's generosity, I think the sheer size of university benefaction from the 1880s suggested that there were like-minded philanthropists who saw universities as a, in Australia, as who saw universities as a crucible of intellectual culture. And that sits in some ways quite interestingly alongside a notion we're all very familiar with of seeing Australia as the land of the bushman, and you know, that strong mythology there, that there was something else happening. Now, there is a postscript to the Macaque bequest, which I think further underscores its importance to the university. In 1920, when the university received its first cheque from Macaque, from the Macaque Trust, rather he was dead of course, the total income from all private endowments jumped from being about half of the New South Wales government's annual endowment and its grants to about 80%, so almost equaling what the state government, what the colonial state government was giving. In 1925, private endowment income actually matched the government endowment. And from the beginning of the Depression in 1929 until just before the outbreak of World War II, the total income from private endowments was worth significantly more than what the government, what the New South Wales government was giving to this university. So that we can really see that private endowments for, you know, much of the university's history have been absolutely crucial to its development, also I think to its development as a public institution, and along the way often prompted, you know, quite big discussions to imagine the university in new ways. Thank you.